I'd like to go ahead and call the Health and Human Services Committee on this afternoon to order. The time is 1:31 p.m., April 14, 2014. I'm joined today by Senator Ellis, Senator Machicki, myself, Stedman, and we have a quorum. We have three bills on the agenda today. House Bill 134 by Representative Costello regarding Medicaid payments for Medicette prescriptions, followed by House Bill 361 by Representative Sadler regarding licensing of behavior analysts. And then we'll conclude with House Bill 281 by Representative Gaddis regarding prescriptions without physical examinations. First up is House Bill 134 by Representative Costello regarding Medicaid payments for Medicette prescriptions. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. And we do not have Representative Costello here. She's preoccupied, but she has her trusty aide. If you can come forward, please. Introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charles Kinchard, staff to Representative Costello. She sends her regards as she was unable to attend due to her obligations in another committee at this time. She has requested that I briefly go through her statement, show a five-minute video, and then do a sectional analysis of this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
So with that, House Bill 134 that you have before you is the sponsor's attempt to memorialize in statute an existing program that exists at the level of regulation. The goal of the Medicette program in the sponsor's vision is to save the state long-term costs by helping our most vulnerable Alaskans stay compliant with their medication. Provided in your packet was a legislative research brief that essentially research shows that when folks are compliant with their medication, their cost of care goes down, and medication management services such as Medicette helps folks stay compliant to their medications. This is a program that is aimed to be targeted at those folks who need it so that the state can realize these cost savings. Mr. Chairman, throughout this bill's process, it has received support, both written and verbal, from the Alaska Mental Health Board, the Chugiak Eagle River Senior Center, the Alaska Commission on Aging, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Alaska Nurses Association, Assets, Inc., the Governor's Council on Disabilities, Hope Community Resources, the Alaska Pharmacists Association, as well as various assisted living homes and pharmacies through the process. So with that, Mr. Chairman, the sponsor has requested that I show a five-minute video that helps explain to members exactly what Medisets are and what the service looks like.
Okay, before you do that, we've been joined by Senator Kelly and Senator Meyer. Go ahead and continue.
Generally, the elderly are at more risk for having more chronic medical problems, but also more severe medical problems. And when you come up with a new treatment plan, they're more likely to have non-compliance with the regimen we prescribe because it's hard to change their routine.
My mother had three strokes. I can honestly tell you when she came home from the hospital, she had close to 20 different meds. It was so much.
The patient with chronic diseases may need medications that have to be administered multiple times during the day. We generally offer the patients with a big bottle of a medication, and they need to figure out when and how often they're required to take that medication.
The social worker at the hospital recommended an agency that came to the house and saw what I was doing, and that's she immediately suggested Medicette. I have no clue on what Medicette is all about.
So she is checking every one of the pills in there to make sure the correct ID is on the medication. This pharmacist here will first look at the orders to see if they see any interactions possible.
And I think that was one of the best decisions I've ever made. Because not only it helped me, I was able to go back to work and be able to put upon my other siblings to help with caring of my mother and make sure that her meds were taken on time and the right ones.
The one thing that is most often needed when you come to this environment is medication assistance. And that is where the staff go and get the medicine, hand it to the resident. And the thing is that we are not allowed to administer.
This is what a patient would take in the morning. So you would have this to where if many medications are in here, you'd have that many different bottles. So you'd have to try to manage so many bottles compared to just opening this pouch and taking everything out.
And a significant portion of hospital and nursing home readmissions are attributed to medication non-compliance. Studies have shown that about $290 billion costs are added to the U.S. healthcare system annually because of the non-compliance.
When you look at the difference between a skilled facility and assisted living, you're talking maybe $14,000 a month to maybe $4,000 to $7,000 a month. If you take somebody who lives at home and they can still manage at home, but they just need, you know, this MediSet to help them stay independent, then you look at someone who is independent in their home that now might have to go to assisted living, again, their private home, to $4,000 to $7,000 a month. The MediSet allows an untrained person to safely assist with medications for somebody. Or someone who's in their own home who gets a MediSet delivered to them, it allows them to possibly maintain some more independence. Many of our residents have changes to their MediSets weekly, sometimes more than once a week. That means that this MediSet program, we would have all of these meds here, and it would essentially, most of those medications would go to waste because they would have to dispose of all of the medications. One example of this is, say someone is prescribed something and they have an allergic reaction to it. I think that it's a valuable service. I think it's one that our industry cannot do without. I think that from a legal standpoint, you would be jeopardizing any of us who are licensed people. Many of the people that come to us may not have families, may not have a lot of resources.
I want to be able to take care of him to his last day. Because it's just how we were brought up that family are important.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'd like to do a brief sectional analysis of House Bill 134. So members will see Section 1, beginning on page 1, line 5. Paragraph A of Section 1, this establishes the fee. There are a few key qualifiers in this paragraph. It says the department will establish a fee to pay a qualified pharmacy for a prescription that requires scheduled units of use to a qualified medical assistance recipient. One part of that paragraph I would like to point out for members is on line 9. It says for a prescription that requires. That's the language that will result in a physician needing to physically write MediSet on the prescription. Moving on to paragraph B in Section 1, starting on line 13, this is the paragraph that addresses pharmacies that are qualified to dispense. It continues on to page 2. On page 2, under this same paragraph, you will see 5 qualifiers. These essentially are what we determined in working with pharmacists and working with the department that are the 5 cost drivers of putting together a MediSet. This means in addition to dispensing a standard prescription, what are the other bits of work that a pharmacist would need to do to put together a MediSet. So you can see, just to briefly go over those, it's consolidating all of a patient's prescriptions, creating the actual medication compliance packaging, offering quarterly review with the recipient, reporting back to the prescriber the results of that quarterly review, and then delivering the MediSets to a patient. Mr. Chairman, this is worded in such a way that these five cost drivers will be incorporated into one Medi-Set fee that the department will determine. Moving on to paragraph C of this same section, starting on line 13, this paragraph addresses who under Medicaid will qualify for a Medi-Set. So to receive this program, a patient will first need to be one of those five that you see in paragraph three, and their doctor will have to actually write it on the prescription. This was language, Mr. Chairman, that was inserted in the bill working with the department, intended to directly reflect who is currently eligible for the program so that the this bill will not expand or contract the scope of who is eligible. Mr. Chairman, paragraph D is two definitions for the bill. First definition is of medication compliance packaging. That's the actual plastic packaging that you saw in the video. The second definition, unit of use, this would be one prescription taken at a specific time. That would be the unit of use. For example, there potentially could be a case where someone only has one prescription, but a prescriber decides that they need a Medi-Set. Maybe it's a prescription that needs to be taken at very specific times that might change. So if there's one very complicated prescription, that's what units of use refers to. Mr. Chairman, moving on to Section 2 on page 3 of the bill. Section 2 and Section 3, these essentially are a very complicated effective date. What Section 2 is, because any change to the state's Medicaid program requires federal approval, Section 2 specifies that. What Section 3 does is that it basically says that when the department has received approval, this statute will come into effect. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my sectional explanation of the bill. I would be happy to answer any other questions or go into more detail if you require.
We have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. Does any committee member have initial questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and start the public hearing portion of the bill. Let's see. We'll jump up on the off-net to Fairbanks. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please. Gerald Brown.
Good afternoon. My name is Gerald Brown. I am a pharmacist in Fairbanks. I work in the pharmacy that does do unit dosing for residential care and for the individual public. I would like to say that I've seen a restriction on this particular bill that says that you must use 75, you must dispense 75% of your business must be Medi-Sets in order to receive payment for unit dosing prescriptions for individuals. And I find that very onerous. We don't have that kind of ratio, yet we do over 900 bubble packs per month. We find that is not a reasonable length, a reasonable ratio, that all pharmacies should be eligible to receive patients or receive this unit dosing fee, because it should not just be those pharmacies that have 75% or more of their business as their business profile. What this does is essentially limit it to just Anchorage being the only pharmacy and only certain pharmacies in Anchorage being the only pharmacies that can receive this payment, and essentially makes it Anchorage-centric. It's kind of like that tennis court that's being granted for Anchorage right now. That's the way this bill is being rostered at this point in time. The other thing is that the last time this dispensing fee was established, it was established on 50 cents per card or 50 cents per unit. We have found that it takes at least $3, and so it needs to be equitable to the pharmacies as far as their costs involved in preparing these and all the records that have to be, that have to go into making this up. So I have some quandaries and some questions as to whether or not there's going to be an equitable service for this. Now, as far as the need is for this service, it is great. In the past month, I've had three people decline services because they could not afford the bubble packing fees, which were $3 per card, or that's established. So three people went without this service because they couldn't afford it. One, we couldn't bill the state of Alaska because it did not represent more than 75% of our business. But two, they couldn't afford it. And so it's really important that, one, the fees established by the department cover the cost of what it actually costs to make it, not just a token cost. And because this is real savings and real health care benefits to the patients and the people of Alaska, and does keep people out of, you know, more expensive care. I stand by for any questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. We will be working on a CS on this bill, and you'll see some changes coming forward on the issue that you spoke today. So I appreciate your testimony.
And I would like to say one more thing. I did hear that there was possibly dropping that 75% to 25%, but I feel that it should be open to all pharmacies because you might have just one patient or two patients that need this service in some of the smaller communities. It would preclude those pharmacies in the rest of the state from able to bubble packing for that particular patient.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Brown.
Thank you.
Arlene Briscoe from Anchorage. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, the committee members. My name is Arlene Briscoe, and I'm a registered nurse with the Alaska Nurses Association. And I work in inpatient mental health setting, and I'm speaking today in favor of House Bill 134. Many of the patients I serve suffer from severe mental illness, which precludes them from remembering to take their medications or from taking their medications at the appropriate time. These patients rely on their Medisets to help them remain compliant with their medication regime, and some of these patients leave with 13 to 14 medications prescribed for medical and psychiatric needs. This makes compliance difficult at best. It is important for these patients to remain living in the community, or we are faced with skyrocketing costs of placing them in assisted living homes or skilled nursing facilities. Home, we must all agree, is the best place for recovery and ongoing health, allowing families to stay together. I am concerned the Department of Health and Social Services regulations that states the department will only reimburse pharmacies to do 75% of their business as Medisets to be reimbursed for this important service. This is totally unnecessary restraint of trade. I know that at my hospital, we often have to keep patients longer because we are waiting on their Medisets medications. This is costing Medicaid and other insurance plans money. Our own hospital pharmacy is not allowed to make these medication packages because they are not 75% of their business. Certainly, pharmacies in more rural communities are not doing volume business. However, if they do run across a patient with 13 medications, it is certainly a time-consuming task, and smaller pharmacies don't have the resources as those who are able for 75% of their business from the Medisets. This program should be available to all pharmacies and pharmacists in the state. Local pharmacists know how to best serve their patients. What is an inconvenience here in Anchorage is a severe problem in small communities. No pharmacy in Delta Junction or Kodiak or Prince of Wales is going to have 75% of their business be Medisets. People from all parts of Alaska need to have local access to this valuable service. It is frequently the difference between a home care setting or an institutional setting. Thank you for your attention and concern to this issue.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Arlene. Next up, Barry Christensen, please.
This is Barry Christensen, calling from Ketchikan. I am a co-chair of the Alaska Pharmacists Association Legislative Committee, and I'll make my comments brief, but we support the concept of putting a statute that Alaska Medicaid should cover Medicep dispensing. However, we do have a problem with the fact that only large volume pharmacies are allowed to do so. We've been on record saying that, and that's pretty much all I have to say. I'm online for any kind of questions that you might have.
Thank you, Barry, for your testimony today.
Thank you.
That concludes the off-net and the LIO list. But we do recognize that there's 6 meetings going on in the building, and some people are having trouble getting into the meeting today. And I'd just like to mention again, we will be coming out with a CS on this on Wednesday to take care of some of these issues. With that, I'd like to go into the room. I see no sign-up sheet for the room. So we'll come back. If we can have the bill sponsor come forward, please. So we'll now close the public hearing. Do we have any final questions, concerns, committee members? Seeing none, thank you. We'll set this bill aside, and we'll work with the bill sponsor on a suitable committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, House Bill 361 by Representative Sadler regarding licensing of behavior analysts. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee, depending on how the meeting goes, because we're running short of time. And if possible, we'll move it along, and if not, we won't. And Representative Sadler, you are here, and if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through this bill, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you very much for hearing HB 361 this afternoon. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 12, Eagle River, Chugiak, Birchwood. Mr. Chairman, autism is a significant and a growing problem in Alaska. If you apply the national rates of incidence to the most recent 2010 census, roughly 2% of Alaska's children are born with this developmental disability, which, as you know, is characterized by a diminished ability to communicate, social isolation, and other challenges. While it is not curable, autism is treatable. Scientific studies do show that early intensive treatment, guided by the principles of applied behavioral analysis, or ABA, offers the best opportunity for people with autism to learn how to function productively in society. ABA is recognized as the most effective form of autism treatment by the U.S. Surgeon General, by the National Institute of Child Health, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. It's best to understand ABA as behavior modification. It assesses the relationship of the environment and a person and their behavior, and then arranges that environment and the interactions between the person and the environment to encourage the desired behavior. You reinforce what works. 40 years of research now, sir, have shown that nearly half people with autism who receive early intensive treatment do not require lifelong services and support. About another quarter can achieve normal functioning after about 2 or 3 years, and sad to say, there's another quarter that is not very reachable. This can mean lifetime savings of between a couple hundred thousand to more than $1 million a year, over a lifetime of a person, and money not spent on institutions, incarceration, emergency interventions, and it accounts for lost productivity as well. Now, an essential element in successful autism treatment is a qualified provider, a well-trained behavioral therapist, and the gold standard for that nationally is something called the Board Certified Behavior Analyst Certificate, or BCBA for short. You'll hear that term a lot. To receive the BCBA certification, applicants need a minimum of an undergraduate and a master's degree, plus extensive training and passage of the very challenging BCBA certification examination. The state of Alaska already supports creating and training BCBAs in our state through a grant to the Center for Human Development at UAA. There's about 26 BCBAs and assistants, which are called BCABAs, in Alaska today, and there's another 7 or 8 in the pipeline, the next tranche of people going through. The situation, sir, is because they are not formally licensed, however, Alaskans with BCBAs cannot bill health insurance and might not be able to bill Medicaid for their services at a rate that reflects their high degree of training and their significant professional skill. HB 361 addresses this situation by providing for those who hold the national BCBA or BCABA credential in Alaska to be licensed not by a professional board, but by the State Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development's Division of Professional Licensing. I would note that this is a product of the ongoing work of the Autism Task Force. We have not presented the final report, but we consider that this is part of the low-hanging fruit that we should get this kind of licensing moving for the benefit of people that suffer from this situation. In summary, Mr. Chairman, by ensuring licensing and higher standards of practice for BCBAs in Alaska, this bill will encourage more people to provide autism services in Alaska, offer higher reimbursement rates for professional providers, protect the public by establishing high standards of professional practice in Alaska. It'll provide better outcomes for Alaska families with autism, save the state money by avoiding the need for costly institutional care, and improve the quality of life for hundreds of Alaskans and their families. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the time to testify. We have a very few people online to offer brief comments, and I understand the Department of Commerce is also in the room. Should we have questions for them? Thank you, sir.
Do we have any initial questions from the committee? We have two fiscal notes. One indeterminate fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. One fiscal note for 46,600 receipt-supported services from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And before we go to the public hearing, Senator Machika, do you have a question?
Well, that was just, I was going to ask the sponsor to cover the second fiscal note, 46 on the first year, and then dropping down a 1.7 after.
Sorry, sir, through the chair, Representative, Senator Machika, pardon me.
Close enough.
That's a term of respect on our side. Which fiscal note, sir? I'm sorry. The number one?
The second.
Department of Commerce, yeah. Community, Economic Development.
Through the chair, Senator Machika, the 46,006 is the initial cost of setting up the database and arranging for professional licensing. The 1.7 subsequently is a very minimal cost, which covers the cost of fingerprinting for new applicants. There's potential for hearing and mediation costs. There's some paperwork, legal support, and so forth. That's a very low cost going forward. And if I may, sir, that's one of the advantages of licensure by the department as opposed to a professional licensing board. There's a lower need for meetings, travel, administrative staff support, and so forth.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now go to the public hearing portion of the bill. We'll go to the off-net. If you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill and try to keep your comments to a couple minutes, it would be appreciated. We will start with Annette Blanis from Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Annette Blanis. I am the director for the Capacity Building and Autism Interventions Project at the Center for Human Development. I'm also a licensed or a board-certified behavior analyst, and I'm the mother of a young man with severe autism. So I'm just going to touch on a couple of points so that I can keep it brief. I am speaking in support of House Bill 361. Families who have children with autism are often desperate for services. With so few options available in Alaska, they will take whatever they can get, even if the service is of poor quality. If issues with intervention services do arise, there is currently very little that families can do to address the problem. Rural communities have limited access to professionals and are at risk of receiving services from practitioners who are not providing quality or safe services. Because rural communities tend to be isolated from other professionals that would recognize these issues early, behavior analysts working in these communities and who do not have adequate skills may continue to provide inadequate or unsafe services. Lastly, families living in rural communities are often desperate for any type of service. This can lead them to accept low-quality services, which can create more challenges than what may have existed before services. Licensure provides a foundation of minimum quality across the profession and in all communities. It also puts in place a system for families and professionals to address ethical concerns and other issues related to service provision. I think others will also talk about the advantage of licensure in terms of being able to receive services, as it allows practitioners to bill insurance companies for those services. So, are there any questions?
Nope, and thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Jennifer Mayhoff from Anchorage. Jennifer from Anchorage.
Hi, this is Jennifer Mayhoff. I'm actually calling regarding House Bill 281.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll put you on 281. We'll go now to Suzanne Lesto, Connecticut, or in Connecticut. If she could introduce herself for the record, speak to the bill, please, and keep your comments to a couple minutes.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Suzanne Lesto. I'm the CEO of the Alaska Center for Autism and the Connecticut Center for Child Development. The Alaska Center for Autism is a private nonprofit school that provides ABA services to children in Alaska. I am also a member of the Board of Directors for the Behavioral Analyst Certification Board, so if there's any questions about how the BACB can help implement this bill, I'd be happy to try to address those as well. I think in addition to what Annette talked about in terms of helping families who are in the rural areas, there's also a need to protect even our large school districts like Anchorage, who are already spending well over $1 million a year on ABA services, yet there's no quality control or any assurance that the monies that are being spent are going to a qualified professional. In addition, I think that the state will save money if even one person in the state is able to come home from an out-of-state placement or prevented from needing an out-of-state placement. The cost of those services will far exceed the cost to operate a licensing credential. I have included in my testimony several peer-reviewed pieces of literature as well as some other documentation that look at the costs and the cost savings, but it is reasonable to assume that over the lifetime of people with autism that we will save a huge amount of money to the state of Alaska by ensuring high-quality ABA services. And not only will we save the state money, but we'll protect consumers, enhance the quality of life for people with autism and their families. And this also has applicability for other populations like fetal alcohol syndrome and traumatic brain injury sufferers. So I'd be happy to take any questions, and I'm a strong supporter of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We're going to have a brief at ease. Come back on the record. That concludes the list of people that have signed up to testify. We'll like to come into the room. We have departmental personnel. Sarah, should come forward. Sarah Chambers, you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and tell us what we have in front of us, and does the department support this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. This bill would, as the sponsor has stated, create a new licensing program that would be governed by the division instead of a board. We would deliver administrative services in order to make sure that the statutes and ensuing regulations are complied with. The department does not take a position on the bill. It's certainly a policy decision to be made by the bodies here in this building. However, we have been working with the sponsor to analyze impacts and have done so and stand ready to answer any questions that you might have about the fiscal or administrative impacts of the bill.
So the department supports this bill?
We don't take a position, a policy position on the bill, but we are prepared to implement it should it become law.
Okay. We have any questions for the bill sponsor of the department? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. No one else signed up, and I don't see anybody's hand sticking up in the back. So we'll come back to the committee. Do we have any final comments, concerns, or committee members? We have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I served on the Autism Task Force along with the sponsor who did an excellent job. This is important legislation. I think it does a good thing to get more professionals into the field and helping out these families that are facing major challenges. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if it's the will of the committee, I will move that the legislation be reported from the Senate House Committee with individual recommendations on to the next committee of referral.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes to the next committee referral. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move this bill on to the next committee referral. Next up, House Bill 281 by Representative Gaddis regarding prescriptions without physical examinations. It's the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and look to the will of the committee depending on how the bill review goes. With that, we have Representative Gaddis in front of us with a trustee or rusty aide. And if she could introduce herself for the record and who she represents and speak to the bill, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. For the record, my name is Representative Gaddis, and I serve House District 9, which is the greater Wasilla area. House Bill 281 is the House companion bill to Senator Dyson's SB 80, which I believe the members of this committee, most of the members of this committee, may have heard in Senate Labor and Commerce or Senate Finance Committees. House Bill 281 is essentially Section 2 of SB 80, so it is not identical. And my staff has provided you with a comparison table for those who've already heard it so that they can differentiate the difference. Comparison table looks like this. House Bill 281 clarifies in statute that physicians may not be sanctioned for dispensing or administering prescription medications without a physical examination of the patient. This practice is called telemedicine. Telemedicine-based medical care would be delivered by primary care physicians located in the state of Alaska. Anyone needing medical care would be a candidate for this system, but imagine the benefits. For a working mother with a sick child, a working mother with more than one sick child, and I have been there before, a rural homesteader, or an employee who cannot take the time off work. Under House Bill 281, patients will be able to obtain over-the-phone or online consultations where physicians can diagnose an ailment and, if necessary, provide a prescription. This bill stipulates that physicians would not be able to prescribe controlled substances. Some benefits of telemedicine are convenience for the patient, affordability, rapid access, higher productivity from a healthy workforce, primary care access for rural residents. The efficient quality of the system comes down to cost and access. Telemedicine does not replace the relationship with a primary care provider. By requesting a consultation and filling out an intake form, consent and medical history forms, a person is entering at that time into a doctor-patient relationship. If a patient does not have a primary care provider, they may designate a telemedicine provider as such. Patient Privacy, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA as we know it, privacy laws apply to telemedicine as well, same as the brick and mortar doctor's offices. Telemedicine already exists and is working in this state. Actually, Alaska has been one of the pioneers of telemedicine. ANTHC has their AFGAN system, so essentially for the acronym challenge, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has their AFGAN system. Thank you.
Welcome to the acronym challenge.
I know better than this too. And the VA, Veterans Administration, and the military use telemedicine outside of our state. Major employers like Home Depot, Costco have their employees on plans with available telemedicine. Usual conditions for which people seek consultation through telemedicine, according to the RAND study that you should have a copy of, are acute respiratory illness, UTIs, skin problems, abdominal pain, back and joint problems. These practices can favorably impact access to care for individuals both living in rural and urban settings. With 20% of our population living in rural areas, it's imperative that access to routine medical care be as quick and economical as possible. My staff and I are available for questions. We also have Dr. DePhillips, the Chief Medical Officer from TeleDoc online, if you have specific questions. And Mr. Chair.
And we've heard the bill, this concept before, so it's not new to the committee. But
say again, please.
So we've heard the concept before here. So go ahead and continue.
You have not heard it in HESS, as I indicated. I believe it's been heard by most of the members here if they were in Labor and Commerce and or Finance. Mm-hmm. So I believe there is one member here that has not heard it.
Okay.
I think the comparison, which I asked my staff to, there is a difference between the two bills. And House Bill 281 requires physicians to be located in Alaska. And I think that that was very important for our Alaskan physicians that live, pay the taxes, and work here. Another difference was the Senate version indicated that you have to bill insurance companies, and quite frankly, my take on it was, if it's a good thing, trust me, insurance companies will utilize this option to lower costs for insurance. So I did not think that that was necessary in my bill. So I'm open for questions.
That concludes your presentation. Okay, do we have initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, we have one. Do you have one?
We have some questions that I wanted to get cleared up that the nurses dropped off, and I think it's just healthy to talk about them on the record. Whenever you think is best for that, I have a couple of questions here.
Okay, we have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And before we drop into the questions, do you have specific questions to the bill sponsor?
I do. So
Chicky.
Yeah, and so part of your bill says that the it depends on properly licensed Alaska physicians, but a lot of the Teladoc folks that you talked about, those companies, some of them don't have physicians in the state. How does that work for them?
And through the chair, Senator Machicki, this bill has gone through the House, through Hess, through their different committees, and quite frankly, we had our doctors say, you know, we're not ready for that yet. We want to protect our doctors here in this state. So if you're not a doctor licensed in this state, you don't get to operate with telemedicine in this state at this time if this bill should pass.
Follow-up
is there's probably, well, several thousand people currently using Teladoc services that would no longer be able to use them.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I can only assume, you know what that does, that you're speaking about the telemedicine that Native Health Consortium uses, and they have a federal exemption that allows them to go outside of the state. So if that's what you're speaking to?
Well, if I may, and there's several companies that use it right now, and their physicians are not in the state either. Well, you named a couple of the large companies, so.
Through the chair, I believe that Senator Machicki might be talking about, in this case, the ones I named were Costco and Home Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could get Dr. DePhillips to speak on that, because he does represent that company, and those companies, or at least one of them.
Okay,
I think he can answer that.
Well, we'll call on him in a minute. Do you have other questions?
If I may, that's not the only company that. So it'd be interesting to hear that. No, I can wait. Well, let's hear that. Maybe the public testimony will help clarify some of these issues.
Okay. We have any other questions from the committee? Okay, we'll go to the off-net. We'll start the public hearing portion. We'll start off with Dr. Henry DePhillips, a Teladoc from Nashville, Tennessee. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, speak to the bill, and possibly help Senator Machicki with his question.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for allowing me in. Dr. Henry DePhillips, based in Nashville, Tennessee, Corporate Chief Medical Officer for Teladoc, the oldest and largest telemedicine provider in the U.S. It's a pleasure to be in front of this group again. So to Senator Machicki's point, there are sort of three large telemedicine companies that have slightly different business models, ours and two others. Two of those three have put together essentially a national network with docs in just about every state. Obviously, it takes regulatory cover to do that. In our particular case, we actually do have some Alaska physicians. We have a difference in interpretation of the Alaska Medical Board rules than the Alaska Medical Board does, which is what prompted this bill. So we actually have been operating in the state of Alaska for a while under the cross-coverage exemption to the prior in-person visit portion of the rules. The Alaska Medical Board disagreed with us and began to censor docs, which is what led to this whole process. what we're looking for, and I think what the other companies are looking for is just some regulatory cover that censoring won't happen again, so we can continue to build out a network in the state, including Alaska licensed and resident physicians. Secondly, we worked closely with the Alaska Medical Association, and we agree with them that the care of the citizens of Alaska should be rendered by physicians who not only are licensed in but are resident in the state of Alaska. I think, unless Representative Gaddis would like me to speak on any additional topics, I think that's pretty much all I have to say at this point.
Okay. Do you have any questions, Senator Machicki, for Dr. Phillips?
Sure.
Dr. Phillips.
Yeah, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman. The other is, why is it limited to physicians when there are others that treat Alaska patients in some cases? In rural areas, we have no physician at all. It's limited to folks that are licensed otherwise.
My guess is that you're referencing, for example, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and other, they're called lower-level providers. That's not a derogatory term, just not physicians, who could certainly do this. I can only speak to our business model, and we made a conscious business decision to keep the bar of care, of patient care, really high. We knew we'd be a target. We have been a target over the last 12 years that we've been in business, and so we just want to keep the standard of care as high as we can. So our model is a physician-only model. The other two of the three large telemedicine companies in the U.S. also have a physician-only model. There are several smaller companies, including one that has been started in Fairbanks. I don't know whether they use lower-level providers as well or whether they're just using physicians, but that's really a business model decision. The other reason why I won't second-guess Representative Gaddis here, but I think the other reason why the bill addresses only the physician level is because it's the medical board that censored physicians doing telemedicine that caused all of this to begin in the first place. The lower-level providers, I believe, are regulated by different boards, not the medical board, and so I don't know that they have run into the same sort of challenge.
Okay, one more question, and I'm covering the questions for a constituent, and you probably heard them. I'm one of those guys who likes to get them out, right? So the last one is about the dispensing. No controlled substances may be prescribed no matter what if the patient doesn't have a health care provider present with them in the room at the same time. Is there a better way to do that in this bill that says prescribed, dispensed, or administered by a physician when an appropriate licensed health care provider or the physician has conducted an exam, diagnosis, and treatment? And I think the concern here is post-op care. So you've already got a case going.
And one that we have talked about with the Department of Corrections and other folks during the evolution of the bill. So this is a little bit of a balancing act, truthfully. The concern is that we'll sort of go back to the late 1990s, early 2000s, when the whole internet prescribing debacle happened, and controlled substances were a big part of that. And so there's a lot of appropriate, I think, concern about allowing controlled substances through telemedicine. Our business model, and again, a conscious business decision, knowing that the bar needed to be high and that we'd be a target, was no DEA-controlled substances through the platform. I believe the other two large companies in the space also have that policy. It just keeps the abuse issue sort of at bay, makes the medical boards extremely happy when they hear that. The Department of Corrections has a model where remote telemedicine will occur. For example, someone's admitted to a particular prison after being arrested, and maybe they're under the influence of drugs, and they do need DEA-controlled substances in order to control their symptoms. The difference there is that there usually is a clinically trained caregiver on the patient side as well as on the physician side of the remote consultation, and I think that's what that's what's being expressed in the wording of the bill as you see it in front of you. You raised, could you state again, you raised a separate issue, post-op. Can you just ask me a little bit more, tell me a little bit more about that situation so I can address it?
Well, just, think about the rural Alaskan who completes their treatment, surgery, or other treatment in, downtown Anchorage and then goes back to the village, has a need for post-op care. Teledoc-wise, is there a way for controlled substances to be prescribed?
Currently not, and I don't have much to give you on that one, just one observation as a physician. I'm a board-certified family doc, by the way. In fact, I'm studying for my board exam, which is this Thursday as we speak. My medical response to that would be, if somebody is post-op and has been discharged, obviously they're doing reasonably well if they've left the hospital, sent back into the home setting, and if they require pain control that a controlled substance level med is needed, that level of pain post-operatively would probably cause me to want to assess that patient in person again one way or the other. Totally understanding the access and rural limitations in the state of Alaska, as I've mentioned to you earlier, I've enjoyed all parts of your state over time, both professionally and personally, so I know the rural nature of the state. But if somebody, you know, has pain beyond beyond the level at which an NSAID or an anti-inflammatory or a non-DEA controlled substance would control, that might cause me some concern. The direct answer to your question, I apologize, should have said this first, is no. Currently through our platform, there is not a vehicle using the telemedicine offering without a clinically trained person present on the patient side to dispense a DEA controlled substance.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Dr. DePhillips. Next up, Jennifer Hayhoff from Anchorage.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Jennifer Myhoff, and I am on the phone in support of HB 281. I don't have the technical background to share that the physician just did, but I wanted to call in representing the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters. We are an association for health insurance agents, brokers, and consultants that really advocate on behalf of our clients who are health insurance consumers, employers, and individuals accessing health insurance plans and care. And we believe that really telemedicine and other alternative healthcare delivery opportunities and platforms have the potential to help contain healthcare costs, which, as you're very well aware, are extraordinarily high in Alaska. So we are in support of HB 281. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. The other folks are just for questions. We have anybody signed up in the room? Only one on there is Sarah Chambers, if she can come forward. Can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing, and I'm available to answer any questions that the committee may have about this bill.
Do you have any, does the department have any concerns or opinions on this subject?
The department itself does not. The state medical board, I believe, as has been already mentioned, has gone on record with their concerns about the bill, but the department itself has not doesn't have a position on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no questions, we have no one else signed up. We'll close public hearing. Any comments from the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would just remind us that this particular bill is not a catch-all. It is not a hospital. But I'll tell you what it does do is it brings us into the 21st century. It allows us to be able to use those things that we now know so well as cell phones or a regular phone, the Internet, to be able to access low-level health care rather than dragging your kids or yourself, spending an hour or two in the doctor's office, and sorry, Dr. DePhillips, who may be on the line, but you know what? We have important things to do, and sometimes we don't go to the doctor's office as quickly as we should because it's time, and time is very valuable for us for a lot of those low-level type things. And just a small story, here in Juneau, I don't have a primary care doctor, and having a cold or something, I put it off and put it off till I finally went to the InstaCare here guy, and I told him, I said, hey, I have a telemedicine bill, and he goes, man, and he bringing out his cell phone and all the gadgets that he said, and basically saying, you know, it is time for Alaska to move into that 21st century where we can get that low-level health care. And what he said is, there's a point in time when you call in with an ailment that is just more than hey, I'm going to tell you to come on in. I can't diagnose or help you over the phone. So, you know, I think that just brings us into an arena that I think some of the Bush locations have been enjoying for a while. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
What's the mood of the committee on this bill?
Can I have an at ease?
Leave at ease. On the record, Senator Machicki.
I move CS for House Bill number 281 to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. We have objection. Seeing none, we'll move this bill to the next committee of referral. This concludes today. Our next meeting is Wednesday the 16th. The agenda will be posted tomorrow. We are adjourned.